This podcast is proudly brought to you by the new Nuke 8 from the Foundry. Nuke 8 includes countless exciting features and updates. In Nuke 8, artists will notice huge enhancements to the dope sheet. The user experience has been greatly improved with the addition of lots of artist-friendly color controls and in-context help. And it's packed with updates that'll make Nuke even better for users across multiple industries. Check it out at the company website, thefoundry.co.uk. Hi, and welcome to this VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour. We are coming to you not with the Google Hangout, just as the straight audio mix, as we said last week on the show. We will be going back to the Hangouts, but we want to make sure we get the audio quality 100% right for you before we do that. And we are entering the arena for the second time to play with our hunger. And I'm joined by Matt Wallen. How are you, Matt?
I'm great.
And representing District New York, I'm also joined by Jason Diamond. How are you?
Hungry.
I think you'd probably be District 1. I'd be District 12, being a southerner from the colonies. And I guess, I don't know what district you'd be, Matt, but definitely a higher one than mine.
I believe I would be the capital.
Ah, well, there you go. So this is obviously the second of the two, second of the four, what will be four Hunger Games films, the sequel to the very successful Hunger Games. This is Catching Fire, a major budget jump and a major jump, I think, as we'll agree, in visual effects. But as we like to do before we get to the visual effects, we just want to do a review of the film. So if I could start with you, Matt, what did you think of this second film?
My inner teenage girl really loved it. I really liked it. It's really fun. I mean, it's it's not like it's a super serious fare, I don't think, really, for me, but it's one that I really like. Jennifer Lawrence, I think she's great. I mean, she's just super cool. And I love seeing a movie like this too, where it's it's a heroine. It's a young female lead, right? She takes the reins and runs the whole show and plays it up in the action star genre, but in a way that's, still sort of in keeping with, maybe the things that are of interest to young women, and, well, and young men too. I mean, I think in the end, it's fun. It's a fun movie. I definitely enjoyed it, and I think they made a good move with this one, going with Francis Lawrence and taking it kind of to the next level, making it feel like a bigger movie.
Yeah, I don't think they actually had any understanding that it was going to be this big when they made the first one. And many have pointed to this being exactly the kind of way a franchise should be run, which is to say that you make the first one without spending $250 million. And then if it doesn't die, it goes well, then you can start building up for the second, third, etc. But if you... I mean, obviously, in the old days, we'd make a film, and if it was greatly successful, we'd make a crappy sequel. But these days, that's kind of flipped on its head. Now, if you make a good film, you can make a sort of an even more successful second and third film, as opposed to, say, a Lone Ranger, which tried to go straight out of the gate for the sort of the top brass ring. One thing I'm interested in is you guys, I guess I should ask you, Jason, have you read the books? Because there's quite a lot of centered around this relationship between the books and the actual content of the film.
I have not. I know people who have, and my editor Michelle, I talked to her about it. I saw it this morning, and actually I saw it at 9:45 this morning, and I happened to stumble into a theater full of two classes of school kids that were, I think, ranging from maybe 7th and 8th grade. And so it was usually at that hour, it's like just me. And so it was interesting to see it in a room full of pretty much the target demographic and to see what they laughed at versus what I found amusing, being that, I guess, in contrast, I'm old.
Matt, had you read the book?
What'd you say?
Had Matt read the book? I was just wondering.
No, I haven't read the first two books. I'm going to admit something that's marginally embarrassing, but after seeing the movie the other day, I did buy the digital copy of the third book and started reading. I started reading it because I kind of want to know what happens.
Well, from what I understand, the issues I had with the second movie are the same issues my friend had with the second book, in that it's basically the exact same story with slightly different plot line.
Yeah, I've read the second and third book, which will become the second, third, and fourth films. I didn't read the first book before seeing the film, and certainly members of my family, my teenage kids, avid readers of the books. And I will say that it holds very, very well to the books. Now, I say very well as opposed to closely, because I think if you've got a successful book, you've solved one of the big problems that we know about going into films these days, which is no one has a script. And in fact, over at FX Guide, we've got an interview I did with Yannick Serz, the visual effects supervisor. And I don't know if it's like we had a very long conversation with him, just terrific chat. It actually went on for much, much longer than is in the podcast, because we obviously cut it down a lot. But I don't think this is actually in that interview, but I said it must have been good when you're bidding this job, because you just hand someone the book and say, I don't have the script yet, but like, here's the book, and it's going to be exactly the same as that. And he said that was exactly the case. It's like, if you couldn't give someone the script because maybe they weren't at a position in that, you know, they could get a script, because obviously scripts don't go to every single employee of, say, a visual effects company, you could just literally pick up the book and you get a really good idea of where everything was going. And I think that's a good thing, because I think getting the script worked out is my criticism of many other films, that they go in and unless they've got extensive budgets that allow them to go back for reshoots, they seem to be sort of working stuff out as they go along, and that doesn't make for a particularly cohesive film. So if you've got a great script that's working in book form, just go with it.
I'll tell you that they definitely decided they could afford a lot more wide shots in this movie.
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to say too, you know, with regards to the story, I mean, I think you make a great point, Mike, about the, you know, working off of a successful franchise of books anyway, like, you know, it's, you don't want to mess with the story too much, hopefully, although you might have to change certain things just for the shift in the medium. But one of the problems I have with the story in general, and I gather from conversations I've had with students, because a lot of my students were avid readers of the books as well, was that that it's true in the books too. But I have to say, I do have one problem with the writer's motivations in the major city in the story, like that we're supposed to believe that the president and the people of the city, they actually believe that what they're doing is going to, with regards to, you know, having these games and sort of then changing the rules, and that this is going to somehow help them quell any kind of rebellion. And the only thing I kept thinking was that, you know, these are clearly like some of the dumbest political leaders ever in the face of the earth. Like, they're making like the worst possible decisions, and they seem like they're making decisions that are actually the opposite of what people would actually do. And that was the one thing that there's a suspension of disbelief I found in the two films so far that I feel like is really required on the part of at least me as a viewer. I feel like I kind of have to say, well, okay, like there's a gaping hole in logic there that doesn't really make any sense, but I'll just kind of go with it. And that was something that, well, I just found really difficult
to turn this into like a socio-political commentary using the Hunger Games as a palette. The issue is that you have, at least it didn't bother me, and I love Donald Sutherland, so I could hear and listen to him read the phone book and it would be fine. But, you know, he his character in the second movie especially, because the first movie you don't see him too much, but in this one he's, you know, doing all the decision making. Clearly he's the one operating from a position of fear, and he's trying to do everything he can to keep his position and his stature. And all the decisions he's making are exactly backwards for just that reason. And
look, I think that's a really good point. He has a view that's much more in keeping with kind of a sane, balanced view, and the rest of society seems to have gone, you know, off the deep end in some kind of bizarre way. But there are two things that I'd put forward to say that I can buy it. The first is that idea of the Roman Colosseum, that people would, watch blood sports that are completely appalling, and you'd think, well, there's no way that you would do that. But if you've got a society, and this is 75 years into this process, that's just grown up knowing this kind of blood sport and that this is normal, then like, okay, maybe that's something that that parts of society just don't question and go along with. And the second one is basically that every day I see things that I don't believe around me. Like, for example, bottled water. Like, who the hell would have said that you could have taken water out of a tap that's free, put it in a bottle and charge like, you know, $3 for it, and people would just absolutely prefer it. And you take out all the fluoride and all the stuff that's good in the traditional water. Never would I believe that. Nor would I believe that some of the idiots on the internet get the kind of numbers that they do. So, you know, there's things in the world that I just believe to be beyond my pay grade, and I just accept that weird things occasionally happen. So I'm willing to go along with that. I will say one thing. This film is, I think, to be contrasted with something like what's going on with the Percy Jackson series. See, the Percy Jackson series is a similar demographic in the nature of the material, a similar set of successful novels, and they completely deviate from the books and the films and are producing a vastly less successful franchise. And I'd like to think that's a good thing. I'd like to think that if somebody writes some really quite good literature that's, you know, appeals to an audience, that, you know, it's, you can sort of point to something like The Hunger Games and say, look, if we don't screw it up, and I would say they did the same thing with Harry Potter, right? As the Harry Potter films went along, they tried to stick more and more closely to the books. That's what people love. That's clearly found an audience. Let's not just assume that we should throw it all out and start again because we can kind of make it funkier and cooler. Lord of the Rings, you know, really stuck to the books when obviously it was quite dense material and for
unfortunately.
I'd say the Lord of the Rings franchise was
more The Hobbit, sorry.
Yeah, but I think the Lord of the Rings franchise, you know, had quite complicated character arcs and plots, and multiple characters had similar names, and all of that kind of had such a basis in strong literature that I thought that the fact they didn't deviate from it was, you know, terrific, just not giving us the sort of dumbed down version. But there's one other thing that I think this has that we should acknowledge right out of the bat before we get to the visual effects. I really think this has a great cast. There's no doubt in my mind that Jennifer Lawrence is producing a very strong acting performance. Like, I often think that visual effects are opening a film and that visual effects aren't given enough credit, but I want to make sure we go the other way here and point out that, like, if she wasn't giving it a kind of gravitas, a real kind of sense of believability, then we'd all go, you know, and not sort of go along with it, because
she holds it up.
Yeah, she's sure. Not sympathetic and sympathetic at the same time. And Woody
Harrelson,
yeah, is great, and I think he plays a really good role. And I think a lot of the other characters.
But then you get, like, I never would have thought The Hunger Games would have, you know, like Philip Seymour Hoffman and Jeffrey Wright and Amanda Plummer, like that. You know the. Yeah. On the beach, the brother sister, like, that's insane.
Well, Lenny Kravitz, I thought, is a remarkable sinner.
He's great, but you can imagine. I mean, that's the role he was born to play. Like,
okay, but what about Caesar Flickerman? Caesar, the game show
Stanley
host.
Tucci is incredible.
Oh, he's amazing.
And that's a role that looks nothing like many of the other roles he's done. And
yeah,
he's just
great.
Stellar. So there's a lot of really good acting here. Well, I think it's great. What are you laughing about?
No.
I agree. I think there is a lot of really good acting. I would say, though, that there were a couple moments in this movie, and I'm going to stick my neck out here because I have a feeling you guys might not agree with this, but I think there were a couple moments, though, in the movie.
Let me guess, that in the movie you thought that Superman was better than Batman. Is that what you're going to say?
No.
Okay, good.
Well, that's
come on, what are we gonna say?
Those were both pretty bad, but I would say that there were a couple moments in the movie that really surprised me, like that I don't know, they were brief, but they were, I think, early on in the film, like when they first arrived at the city, and then maybe when, and they were in the train, I think, and then once when they first arrived on the in the game, there were a couple brief expository scenes of dialogue.
Oh yeah,
where the delivery of the dialogue, I thought it was almost like they had chosen either editorially or directorially, they chose a take that wasn't really the best take in terms of the actor's performance. And it sounded kind of, the lines were delivered in kind of a wooden way. And it happened a couple of times. And I couldn't tell if it was that it was the take and it was the actual on-set audio, or if it was some sort of like an ADR thing where they had gone back and done some, dialogue recording in the studio, and it just didn't sound quite the same. It didn't have the same emotive quality. But I don't know if you guys saw that at all, but it was one of those things where in a movie like this, where the budget is so big and there's a guaranteed audience where they know they're going to probably make at least as much money as the first movie made, if not more. And I think it did make a little bit more than the first one, if I'm not mistaken. And I was surprised that some of those takes wound up in the movie, because they were, I don't know if you guys saw that, but there were a couple that were just really flat delivery of lines, a couple from Jennifer Lawrence. Even.
Yeah, I mean, I could find definitely some really kind of bland expository moments in the movie, for sure.
But I don't think they had to be that way. That was what was interesting, is it seemed like they were like, it felt like, they probably did like a couple takes of, I'm sure, of each character's lines from, different angles and stuff. And it just seemed like they chose ones that weren't the best. And it made me wonder, in terms of, as a director, I worked once on a Francis Lawrence movie, on the I Am Legend movie. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't one where there was a lot of heavy duty dialogue, right? It was Will Smith kind of talking to his dog most of the time. And I thought it was, and I can't remember any of the other, what are his other films? You guys know off?
Sorry, you're talking about the director's films now?
Yeah.
Francis Lawrence.
Oh, no, he's done quite a bunch of stuff. But the I Am Legend thing, really stands out from the bunch. Because he did a bunch of film clips back in the day.
I was just wondering if he's because I think he's got an incredible visual style, right? Like, he's a super visual director. And I just wonder if, I don't know, I mean, it's a stretch to say this total, supposition on my part. I'm just sort of, throwing this out there, but I wonder if he's like an actor's director or if he's more of a visual director.
Well, Elephants, Water for Elephants, Constantine, but he did a bunch of film clips. I'm going to say he did that really famous Green Day one where they were coming back into, I'm pretty sure.
He's done tons of music videos.
Yeah, did that one. You know the one they came back into after Katrina, but they replaced the army instead of the, how it could have been.
Yeah.
But if I had any criticisms about the movie, I think that would be my criticism, was that there were some poor take choices.
I mean, it was certainly a second. By now we've all been patterned to know what a second film in a trilogy should be, especially after Empire Strikes Back. And this definitely follows that model, right? I mean, it's dark. It ends really dark. It ends with a cliffhanger. Shit just goes from bad to worse. So at least they got that right.
Well, that's also how the book ended, actually.
No, I'm assuming it did. I'm just saying,
Yeah.
You can never know what a studio's going to do when they start spending a lot of money, how they're going to, mess with the tone of something to make sure it, meets their... Excel sheets.
Yeah, though I would give them credit for lifting the bar and making it still seem like it was part of the same franchise.
Totally all in. I think it's for, you couldn't have this movie obviously without the first movie, but I think it's better than the first film.
Yeah,
I enjoyed it more. That.
Now Yannick Sears came in, and actually we discussed. Sheena on the last show, she was the visual effects supervisor on the first one. Yannick Sears came in on the second one, and as many of you would know, he was the visual effects supervisor off Avengers, Iron Man 2. He's done a lot of second unit directing as well, so it's like this guy is just really talented, full stop, but incredibly experienced going back to the Matrix film. So by Avengers standards, this isn't a big, big film, like 1,200 shots, but having said that, I think a lot of the stuff that was done in this film was really good. And the dimension that this has that sort of also should figure into our discussions is the use of IMAX, because while this film didn't go down the path of doing 3D the way many films have, it went down the path that some other films have done, which is shooting large sections of the film in the IMAX format. And this is particularly the case once they got into the arena, which caused, as we'll here, I'm sure, in the discussion, some problems because they literally couldn't render it at IMAX res. It was just so complicated. That being said, you know, only because the team behind this, companies like DNEG and Weta and Method and stuff are so hardcore, can you not say this is as big a film as they've done before, just because some of those companies have done, you know, incredibly big visual effects films. So I was wondering if I could start with you, Jason, get your sort of overall assessment of the visual effects of the film, now away from the plot. There's obviously stuff outside the stadium and then an enormous amount of stuff inside the stadium. What do you think?
I thought they were mostly good. I think I didn't like any of the exterior wide train shots. I thought the train just looked kind of like a toy. It just didn't feel right to me. And the physics were off. I think on the very first one, I remember, I think it's kind of like mid-screen, it's going left to right, and the physics of the speed, maybe it's because the plate, it's an aerial plate, and it's sort of drifting to the right, but the way that the train comes in and exits the frame just felt totally wrong from a physics perspective in its speed and its parallax to the plate.
It was like it was going too fast, right?
With the speed. It had like a hitch in it somewhere, and I don't know, I remember just kind of being like, whoa, that didn't feel right. Cause I try not to watch with a critical eye. I try to watch and only really start to notice stuff if things start to jump out, because I want to watch the movie and have everything just work and be in the movie. If I could sit there all day and, you know, pixel peep the shit out of it, that's annoying. That's not how it's meant to be viewed, right? At least on the first viewing. So
sure. Well, I should clarify, you didn't see it in IMAX, just to be clear.
I did not.
Okay, I've seen it both in IMAX and not in IMAX. I believe the train sequence you're talking about was a Method Studios shot. Could be wrong, but that's certainly they did that in the party and the Caesars show, which included that amazing Mockingjay dress. Were there any other shots that bugged you?
I mean, having seen films like Source Code that really nail the "you're on a train, but you're on a set" kind of vibe, I think that the train interior, while set dressed gorgeously, the exterior, it just feels too clean for me.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
I mean, they had good reflections in the glass, and, you know, it wasn't a compositing thing. I think it was just an overall, the style they went for. Not visual effects specific, but just the overall style that the production went for the interiors. I didn't, and I know it's a modern train and it's super futuristic and maybe there's no bob and weave to the car, but we live in 2013 and the train cars still bob and weave. So I kind of need to feel that, at least me personally, to feel like you're on a train just a little bit. And I felt like it was a little stable for me.
That's interesting you should say that. Matt, one of the things that came out when I was talking to Yannick is that when characters were moving, and in particular, I'm going to use the example of when they're coming into the arena as part of the tributes parade, he was very adamant that if anyone was on a moving device that was going to have green screen behind it, they'd be moving. I believe, for example, you could have done that shot with somebody standing on a platform and kind of shaking it slightly side to side. And then, of course, you just move the background behind them, the green screen, and they are effectively static. But Yannick's thing was, if you want someone moving, we should move them and have a big green screen, and then we can composite in something, and only then it'll give it the right movement. So I guess my question would be, leaving the train aside for a second, did that work for you in, say, the arrival at the stadium for the tributes parade?
Yeah, you mean in the city when they kind of cruise through? Yeah,
in the chariots.
Yeah, actually, yeah, I actually thought the, like Jason said at the beginning, I think, you know, they did a lot of stuff in this movie, and that sequence in particular, where they really opened up the world and gave you much more of a grand sense of, you know, what I guess it's District 1, right? The city itself and the capital. And I think that that was really effective. It was, you know, the throngs of people lining the main sort of avenue there that's kind of like, the Champs-Élysées or whatever, you know. And they're all kind of moving towards palace at the end of the avenue. And I thought that that was really effective. And I think that the, you know, the cityscape, the setup of the city, the way in which the city was laid out, which I think was probably Dineg, right, that did all that work. I thought that looked really great. And the supervisor, that idea of moving the actors, making sure that they're actually moving forward as well as doing, you know, whatever the chariot itself might do. I mean, that's just smart. You know, that's really smart to do it that way always. I mean, because you're going to get something that is like what you want it to look like. You know, I mean, if you want it to be that somebody's riding in a chariot and they're moving forward down a street, then, you know, if you have the means and the ability to do it that way, that's the way you should do it, because it's going to give you the right, just the right kind of, you know, subtle body language. And the fact that, you know, not only would an actor be moving side to side if you were just on a, you know, a static thing, but if you're moving forward too, you're also, you know, you're going to have to sort of, like, you know, in a subway car or something, when the subway starts to move, right, you're going to have to kind of lean forward a little bit and lean back as the forward and momentum shifts and somewhat. And I think that that's something that it's subtle, but you, if you're watching somebody move in that way or be moved that way, but in a vehicle, you know, your eye is trained to see that. It's just something that you'd naturally expect. And I think that was a great choice. I thought it worked really well.
Well, it's those subtleties that sell it. Like the rule of subtlety that I always go back to is when they did the first digital Yoda for Episode 2, I think it was, Star Wars. And I had read a long article about it, and they said, you know, they're like, we for the longest time, we couldn't make it work. And we were like, why can't we make it work? We've modeled this thing to the teeth. It's like, it couldn't be a more perfect model. The animation couldn't be more dead on. It's not working. Why? They went back and watched Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, and they realized that because the puppet is rubber, there's these really subtle high-frequency vibrations in the rubber, in the ears especially. And they're like, oh, because, you know, Frank Oz's hand is shaking slightly. And when they added that high frequency movement back into the digital model, it like came to life. And so it's the same thing as what you're saying, which I agree with 100%, you know, practical body movement. And we talked about that in the Gravity show too, practical body movement that sells to the viewer. You know, the viewer sees this giant cityscape and says, oh yeah, I've never been to this world, but I know that those are human beings and they should move a specific way. And I think that the VFX supervisor, like you said, I agree with you, was a really smart move. And especially since they had the means to do it, to move them for sure. And I really like the Sims on the burning, or the, you know, I know it's not actually fire because it's whatever the effect is.
Girl on fire dress.
Yeah, in the world effect.
Yeah, the embers were great, weren't they?
Yeah, but the embers were great.
I thought that was really good. And I was going to say the other one was spectacular, was the work that was done on her dress turning into the Mockingjay dress.
Oh, it was phenomenal.
By Method.
A little black swan,
it was a bit black swan, I agree. But can I just geek out with you for a second? I tried doing this with Yannick as much as he could do it from his position. But I was struck when I was preparing to talk to him and I was doing the research, and I thought I'd ask you guys the same question. It struck me that if you had like a piece of paper and we were sitting around, the three of us, as, I don't know, filmmakers, I guess, and saying, okay, well, we're going to spin this out to multiple facilities because that's what you do these days. So like, if you wanted to say who would be your top two or three companies in any of these areas that you wanted to do, it felt like they nailed those companies. Because if you said to me, yeah, who's going to do a really good urban environment or, you know, like a sort of a city, and I'd be like, well,
yeah, Dineg.
Yeah. If you said, I've got some digital monkeys, I'd be Weta.
Yeah.
And if you go, I was close. On the holograms, I was thinking, well, that would be Prometheus, right? That would be Fuel. Though, as it turned out, that was actually Hybrid. Though Fuel did the other holograms in the training center, Paul Butterworth being the soup on that and very good at it. But it was just like, you know, almost in every area you went. And the game show, right? Like, that's so Method Studios to me. Like, it was perfect for them, right? So, I mean, I don't know if these were all their first choices, but it just seems to me like none of those companies are coming at that cold. Like, every one of them has just an incredible track record
But I think that's a great point. I think that's something too, though, that like even, you know, back in the old days of the beginning of sort of the digital shift in visual effects, I remember that was kind of the case early on too, where there were specific facilities that were really good at certain things. Like I immediately think of Tippett Studio, which I still think has this reputation for being a place that does, you know, really, you know, bang up great creature work, right? Like that's kind of one of their specialties and stuff. And I do think that, you know, that sort of does become stock and trade for some of these facilities, even when they become, you know, much larger, as a lot of the like DNEG and stuff, some of the other, and Weta, of course, now, right? They're just.
But seriously, after Planet of the Apes and King Kong and stuff, if you wanted to have a bunch of, you know, apes attacking, like mandrels, I mean, really? Is there anywhere else you'd be thinking? Let's just see if Weta's busy, because I think Guy Williams could actually nail that pretty well. Yep, pretty good. I mean, they're actually doing another Apes movie right now, right? The sequel to the last one. So, yeah. But I mean, in every respect, I've left out a couple of like Rodeo FX, who did environment and set extension work, which again, you know, I would have said, yep, that's right up their alley. I mean, obviously, there are a few companies that could do previs, so Proof is completely great. But I would say there are a couple of companies that I wouldn't say that the previs is quite in the same category as, do you know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't say Third Floor has a particular style of previs over Proof that I could differentiate. But I definitely think in the main effects houses, that's like, it's like an A team in each of their sectors.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, if you had a bloody great spaceship battle, you'd stick ILM in there and you'd be done.
True.
Sorry.
I was going to say, can I just jump right to the Training Center Cube guys?
Sure.
Because I really, really like that. Outside of the aesthetic of it, I really like the sound design. I really like that they went far enough to make it sound like cubes hitting the floor when the cubes hit the floor, instead of it just being, oh, well, it's digital. It wouldn't make any sound. It would have a zap and they would go away. And the fact that it has, like, you know, the sound of, you know, 150 cubes hitting the floor in random sizes and volumes, really, I appreciated that a lot.
Yeah, it was really nice work, wasn't it? And okay, it was a complete departure from the level of tech they had in the first one. And there was a throwaway line in there. Whoa, we've got a whole new training center. Really?
Yeah.
Upped it quite a lot, actually. But yeah, no, it was very good. And made for a delightful scene, albeit that some people have pointed out there were no arrows on the floor after she'd shot all these holograms, where they all go. But anyway, notwithstanding that, and the fact that she did seem to have an endless supply of arrows in the actual arena. I thought it was a great set. Okay, so let's get to the arena, though, because the arena for me is spectacular at so many levels. I think it was the one that I was most wanting to see, because having read the book, I knew that they would spin the arena, or at least the cornucopia, and I was like, oh my God, that's going to be really hard with water. And not only that, but they've got a tidal wave that comes down, they've got a huge digital environment. For those people that don't know, almost all of that environment was digital. They did shoot some stuff in Hawaii, but that's like stuff on the beach, sort of close-up stuff. The stuff jumping off the platforms was done at a Water World in Atlanta. And the spinning cornucopia was a set piece with no water in the car park of the same thing. So for me, the whole digital environment in the forest was always going to be a hard thing. But I want to see if I can just start with the fog, because it was the one that struck me the most, and I didn't anticipate it until I saw it. But when I saw the art-directed, clearly digitally controlled fog moving around the various leaves and things acting in a lethal way, it struck me that either all the leaves had to be digital, or somebody had to roto every leaf and work out the depth and placement of every leaf, then a LiDAR scan isn't going to get you there because they all move. And sure enough, that's what they did. They literally had people sitting there hand rotoing and working out all of those leaves so they could put their fluid gaseous simulation crawling over the top of it. And I just think that was a heck of a lot of work, but it came off really, really well. Matt, do you want to comment?
Yeah, I mean, I think that whole arena, I completely agree. I think it's spectacular. And I think the way in which they brought all of those elements to bear in that whole sequence in the film, I mean, it really, the whole movie changes once they get into that space. And I think it, you know, I kept kind of waiting to see, like, because I hadn't read the second book. I'm like, oh, are they going to have another game? I guess they are going to have another game. And then, you know, where's this going to be? Is it going to be like the last one? And the fact that it was in this sort of jungle environment, I thought was great. And I love the look of there was one like helicopter shot, which I think is probably my favorite shot in the whole movie, of the arena, where it looks down and you see the sort of like the clockwork jetties and the circular beach, you know, with it's like a slow moving kind of helicopter like shot moving across that with the jungle and the hills in the background. And you see the sunlight coming across the water being broken by the movement of the water, but also then by the sort of angular jetties coming out from the center. And I thought, you know, that was one of those things where, you know, clearly it's a totally digital recreated environment because it doesn't exist anywhere like that. And I think that's something that, just the lighting, that hard sunlight, and making that look so believable and so real, I just thought was so cool. And yeah, and I thought that whole, the smoke too was the other thing that I was going to talk about tonight that I thought was so cool, is that those fluid sims and getting that stuff to sort of the menace of it as it starts to move, you know, in and around and through the foliage, this really dense foliage, and you're not really sure, because it's so dense in the distance. I thought what made it really effective cinematically too is that as it starts to come towards the players in the game, you're not sure if you know, when they start to run away from the smoke, are they running in the right direction? You know, because then it would start to kind of come around the edges and sort of had these kind of like little fingers almost moving through and around some of the trees. And I thought that stuff was just really, really successful.
Yeah, well, that big traveling shot that moves sideways around the arena is the shot that I was referring to earlier, that they just literally couldn't render in IMAX, and they had to render it. And then sort of up-res it a bit, which didn't hurt at all, I don't think. But I saw it in IMAX, but, you know, 4K of all of that moving foliage. Because one thing that they really wanted to do, and I think you'd probably appreciate this, Jason, they really wanted to keep the forest alive and not just have it as a big dead kind of space. So there's leaf movement, there's fog, there's smoke, there's cloud, there's, of course, there's water movement. I mean, you know, you'd sort of in mathematical terms maybe think that water would become like a mill pond, but they never played it that way. They always kept everything moving to keep it kind of really visually interesting. And I thought it was pretty successful.
Yeah, I you know, I kind of had to, once I realized they were going to play the game again, I kind of had to be like, all right, now I'm starting to realize that it's the same plot again, it just with different players. I sort of was like, all right, let's see what happens. And I did really like where they went with it, because you had Lenny Kravitz's character before she goes up in the tube to see what the environment is. He says to her, I think it's going to be tropical or something, because it's really sunny up there, and I mean, it might be a desert. Like, it might. So they clue you in with the dialogue beforehand that it's okay, it's going to be different. It's not going to be the same. But, you know, the other thing that's interesting, though, is, you know, if they think, this is just a plot thing, if they think that she's so dangerous, she comes from, like, a forest background where they show her constantly in the forest hunting shit, but they always put her in forest-based games. So are they not giving her advantage? I don't know.
Well, no. So the theory is, from a plot construction point of view, the first time it's a fairly neutral environment, though they have the mutts that come up and they have the fire. In the second one, as opposed to the first one, where it's really player against player, the second time it's really players against the environment. So this environment is vastly more complicated, more lethal, and more of a threat than the first one. Because most of the time in the first one, apart from, as I say, when those mutts pop up at the end and when the fire moves her back in, the environment itself isn't what's killing
them.
That's true. They knock those hornet type things off and that's fine. But here it's like every section of this is the capital effectively against them.
I have to say, when the tidal wave came down, I couldn't tell it was water initially. In the wide shot, I thought it was smoke.
Well, they wanted it to be like you couldn't see what was happening, like it was happening under the trees and you were just seeing the effect, and then it would come through for that big for that big splash in the in their in the you know what do you call it the wedge I guess that was the
yeah but in the profile shot the water when like they so you see it come down at you and then they cut to a profile shot of it coming past the cornucopia in the middle and I thought that that shot I was unclear until the tidal wave settled at their feet that it was actually water and that it wasn't some sci-fi weird like liquid because from the profile when it hits the cornucopia it does this kind of spiral up against the back of the cornucopia and it looked almost like mercury or something like it had this
because of the force fields.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree with you, Jason. I think I was going to say that exact same shot, like the one shot where it's I liked how the trees coming down and stuff. I thought that was really cool, whether it's like it's, you know, like, you know, King Kong or whatever coming to take Fay Wray or something, you know, these sort of trees in the distance getting knocked over. I thought that was really cool. But then that was one thing that I didn't quite understand. Having not read the books, it wasn't clear to me that the idea of the force fields and when the water is it's a shot. It's really just the one shot for me that was really weird where it's sort of you're at ground level, I think, and we're tracking towards the cornucopia and we're tracking with the wave moving from screen right to screen left and seeing it in profile where we're actually looking at, I believe then, it kind of up against the invisible force field. So we're seeing both under the water and the surface. And that initially for me as a viewer, I think is kind of what you're describing too, Jason. It was something that it was really disorienting. Like I was like, well, what the hell is
now,
that?
Like, we'd already seen the fog at this stage, right? Because that was the first one.
The fog was earlier. Yes.
Yeah. And the fog had the wall. It came up at the wall. It stopped.
It was a close up.
Well, that's true. But I guess I knew it was going to do exactly that because it's described exactly like that in the book. So I guess I was thinking that the audience that didn't read the book would get it because they'd have understood that there were these wedge force fields from the fog.
I think what was different, though, is that with the fog, if memory serves in the film, with the fog, the way that we understand the resolve in the fog is that it comes up and we're looking down on the players.
Yeah, the top shot, and they're lying there and you see this wall.
Yeah, and so you know, you're oriented visually, you know, from this idea of looking down from above, and you don't understand that it's a wedge, but I thought they had fallen into this ravine where, you know, it couldn't go lower is sort of how I interpreted it. Like the smoke couldn't go further down. And I think that just as a sort of an uninitiated, you know, viewer of the movie, like that was something that for me, the juxtaposition of those things until they explain it in the expository scene later where they start talking then about the clock and this idea of these different things happening within each segment, that wasn't clear to me.
And the Jabberjay sequence where they go in where they're hearing the voices, was that so? Presumably, by that point, you'd kind of got it because that's the same force field there. He's pressing his head up against it when she's
That made sense.
Yeah, by
again,
that point,
because
it made
you
sense.
See her, because you see her hit it, and you can't, you know, you get the cue from the fact that they can't hear each other. And I just feel like, and honestly, until you just said it now, I really didn't get that there was a force field for the water because it comes up at their feet. You know,
well, it gets stopped by the force field, and then the force field drops, and it spills over on top of the cornucopia, and then goes out to each of the 12 areas. Yeah,
but it's just I like the spray. Like after that profile shot, they cut to like a front shot of the cornucopia, and you see the spray come up on the cornucopia. That was great, but it was just I think the whole force field thing. I know they had Jeffrey Wright explain it in the training center, but I think it needed like one more expository line, even though I hate exposition.
or one other visual cue, I think, prior to the water coming down, cue. Maybe.
Yeah, it's
like
an interesting problem, isn't it? Like designing visual effects shots where you absolutely understand what's going on and you're wondering, have I given enough for the audience for them to understand what's going on? Because once you've read the book and you know what's going on, I would have never thought that wasn't clear. So it's an interesting balance. I'm really interested to hear you guys say that. Of course, it's a plot point that it has to break out of its area a bit because if it doesn't cause a surge of water to go up onto the sand isn't wet and the whole idea of electrocution doesn't work. So they, you know, they kind of bend the rule a little, right? Like the fog is strictly contained inside its quadrant or its sector, but the water spills out of its sector for what will become a significant...
And is that only based be just a physics issue? That it just, you know, I mean, it has to... The water has to go somewhere because it's a specific volume, whereas the fog can dissipate, so it doesn't need to exist anywhere but in its force field volume. I don't, I'm just being getting petty here, but
sorry, I don't follow the question.
I was just saying, going to back to the Mike Seymour VFX show rules of physics. The reason that the outside of the plot point that it has to hit the beach, also volumetrically, the water has to escape past the quadrant, because otherwise every time the water, the tidal wave came down,
it would fill up.
It would keep filling it up.
Yeah. Though, I mean, you could always come up with some sort of rationale that it gets drained as the fog is sucked away clearly and doesn't just stay there. So too, the water could be, you know, dumped from underneath somehow. I think it was just literally the plot point. You had to keep wetting the sand, or you wouldn't have the reason that no matter where they were in the 12 sectors, they would get electrocuted. Go on.
I was going to say, I did like the clock reveal. Like, that was not immediately clear. And then one, you know, like, you, I don't personally didn't even think that that was going to be something relevant to the, when I saw the first overhead and saw all the people, like, it was a great reveal. And they're especially because Philip Seymour Hoffman's character until that point seemed entirely useless to me.
What I liked about it though also was that, you know, you could have had this situation where you go, hey, if the forest is so lethal, why don't you just go and hang out at the cornucopia again, because you could see anyone coming and it'd be really safe there, and you know, you're not going to get hurt there. And then it's like, well, actually, you're going to get dumped on by a wave, and if you stay there, they'll just spin it until you fly off and hurt yourself. So yeah, I can't stay there. I have to go back out to the dangerous outside quadrants or sectors. So there it was a good kind of, there was nowhere to hide, I think. There wasn't any obvious solution. Well, clearly the place to stay is here, kind of thing. You know, sometimes in these things, you kind of go, well, why would you even go there? Why don't you just stay where you were?
I thought once it started spinning, which was great, you know, great plot point, you know, oh, well, now that they figured it out, just, we can just spin it. And now they'll have no idea what's going on, even though they still know the tree.
Yeah, the tree's a bit of a 12 o'clock,
but, you know, whatever. I thought in the, I guess they were kind of medium shots, like in the spinning in the wide shots was great, but in the sort of medium shots where it was just all this sort of white foam or white water around them, the water looked a little like Sci-Fi Network, for lack of a better description, like Sharknado-y, you know, like it just looked a little simmy and a little like there wasn't a lot of, I'm trying to describe this properly for the proper criticism. It didn't seem to have actual inertia. It just seemed to be really smeary Sims.
Yeah, difficult problem, isn't it? Getting that to work. I thought it was pretty good. I was surprised to learn later that they had no water when they were spinning. They were just on a giant kind of Lazy Susan thing. But it did feel a little digital in the medium close-up shots, just in the sense that, it was like a difficult problem.
I mean, you don't have any reference at that point in that shot. There's no physical reference for inertia or speed. So, it's just a weird, it's a framing issue. I don't know.
He did spin them for real, Yannick said, because he wanted the light to change over them properly. Yeah. And that was that same principle of with the chariot. So I think that was good. Hey, I want to loop back if I can. We talked a bit about weather and stuff, and I never actually got your opinion on the digital baboons, these vicious kind of monkeys that attack. And they are sort of the only, am I right, I'm thinking the only characters, apart from some birds, I guess, that we sort of see that are sort of fully digital.
There's one lizard.
There is a lizard. That's true. Like a chameleon, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Cute guy. I'm sure he can get his own car commercial. What did you think of the baboons?
I mean, I thought they were good. I don't think they're of the level of the work of, you know, say the chimps or the orangutan or whatever in the Planet of the Apes film.
Wasn't that orangutan a high watermark? Oh, that was good.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the matted hair, like, hanging from the arms as it swings under the Golden Gate Bridge and stuff, I mean, that stuff is just so spectacular and, like, so just such an attention to detail in that character. But I think that, you know, these were good. I mean, they fit the bill for what they were supposed to do. They were better, I thought, certainly by a factor of, you know, 100, I think, than the weird dog creatures in the previous film. And they sort of serve the same purpose, right, in terms of the game. It's this kind of, you know, corralling kind of movement through the arena. But I thought they were good. And I thought in particular the shots that I thought were the strongest were the close-ups underwater of the one that sort of tackles, I guess the Katniss character, right? Tackles her and pushes her underwater and is lashing out. And so the teeth are coming out of the snout, right? They're kind of, and the gums are pulling back and you're seeing this real, threat display and, you know, physical attack happening. And I thought that was the most successful, for me. And the rest of it, I think, was just, you know, they moved quickly. They moved like, you know, baboons, and there was menace, and they were just kind of freaky.
Yeah, I thought so. I thought that underwater stuff was particularly hard to do because of, you know, obviously all the sort of optical effects. But then I loved when it died, it had that sort of sudden falling limp, falling to mm-hmm. one side. And I just remember thinking to myself, that's a good animator, because you've got such life in this, and then you've got such, you know, sort of complete lack of life in just a couple of, you know, like, you clearly it's still moving, it's tipping on its side, but you've just nailed it in terms of taking the life out of it. And then doing all that with, of course, the fact that it was, you know, not a perfect environment upon which to composite something in on. So I've got no idea who did it, but I mean, the Nuke team that put that in there must have been working there, because there was a sock puppet that she was basically looking at while it was all going on to get that out, to get the baboon in, to get it looking like it's underwater, and to get it looking as well as it did. I mean, somebody seriously out there compositing, you know, merit badge that day.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree, for sure.
Especially on a close-up when everyone's looking at it, you know, like, what else are you looking at? Nothing on screen, just completely fixated on that thing in front of you.
I was gonna also point that out as my favorite use of the baboons. I thought it was a nice choice, maybe, to make it family friendly, to not give them the big baboon butts. But you know, maybe, you know, it is another world.
Yeah. So, this is a female baboon in estrus.
Yeah,
I always remember that from my anthropology classes in college, right? The female chimpanzee in estrus was always...
I'm so sorry. I did not do that at college. I did a lot of other things at college that involved drinking.
Well, I had to take the anthropology classes because that's all the hot girls took those, right?
Yeah.
Because I was doing pure maths.
Lots of naked Africans.
I can tell you there weren't that many girls in pure maths and computer science. Which, you know, I think is a shame, right? Because I think that there would have been much better. But obviously, yes. I was exactly what you would imagine a pure mathematician would be like, yes, at university.
You could calculate the odds of why there weren't any
women in the section that we were in. Yeah, I will say this: to amuse ourselves at university, we used to come up with some quite good pranks. We once carried a sofa into our lecture, in maths lecture. Just sat it in the front, sat on our sofa, and when we finished the lecture, picked up, walked out. The lecturer didn't blink once. Right, like, completely natural that you would just walk in with a sofa. We were just over sitting on the benches. And then no one else seemed to care either. I was like, that's what I loved about university. Like, just, it was just, you were there to learn. And if you want to learn and want to sit on a couch that you brought in with your own tea set, go for it. The eccentricities of life. Ah, wonderful yeah. things. Okay. So leaving aside my marvelous university days, which I love to death, we have the finale, of course, with the big, I guess, many have cited this as being a very heavy religious kind of rebirth, crucifix type metaphor of her being pulled out of the burning blaze of the stadium. But I mean, that whole end sequence was a bit stylized, a little different from what happens in the book, just microscopically, in that scene that happens in the plane, it's something that I don't remember being in the book. she's certainly a lot sicker and a lot worse off for wear when she's in the book. She certainly can't get up and unplug an IV from her arm and go and attack someone with a syringe. But inside the stadium, that final, you know, thing falling, that big sections of stuff coming mm-hmm. down that gracefully miss her and don't kill our heroine. What do we think, Jason?
I was slightly confused initially by what was going on.
I think you were meant to be.
Yeah. But I thought that the like really macro and diopter work on her while she's there sort of in repose was really beautiful. Might have been some of my favorite camera work in the movie. It just was really, you know, really nicely composed shots, really great, uber shallow depth of field, but not gratuitously, but just because you're living there with her in the moment. And then the lifting up, I thought the fact that it was all in slow motion, I did think it was a little, you know, over the top Matrix, you know, with the arms out, because, you know, I don't know, it would seem really dangerous that your arms would be out dangling from a claw, you know, at 200, 300 feet. But, you know, hey. But I thought I thought the camera work was really nice in that. The visual effects were good. They did their job. But I think the camera work and the overall storytelling in that moment was really nice.
Okay. Me. Matt?
Yeah, I mean, the iconography doesn't bother me at all. It's like, that's never really, it wasn't, I didn't think it was, I didn't think it was as heavy as some other films we've talked about more recently, maybe. I'm trying to think of what the one was that had so
Superman.
Much of that.
Superman?
Well, yeah, maybe, because it was Superman, right? Yeah, and it wasn't as heavy-handed as that, I didn't think, and I thought that, I agree with Jason. I think those shots of her lying on the floor and then being lifted up, I thought they were beautifully photographed. And I was sort of like, wait, what? Why is she shooting it at the ceiling? And then I was like, oh, okay, so she's going to, like, you know, futz up the whole, you know, the projection on the dome. And then once the lightning and the arrow hit the dome, and then it sort of shorts out the projection, I wasn't clear why the dome was collapsing. Like, did the short cause the collapse, or did the rebels then at that point
rebels broke attack? In together. Yeah,
like they broke in and together. Shot it up. Yeah. Okay, and I actually thought as it was falling away, like, look at the shots of sort of that she, I think it was her point of view, right, looking up, and as you start to see the structure and the sort of the girders and the, you know, the big you know, concrete or whatever that's part of the dome structure, as you start to see those things kind of fall apart, and it's almost like there's like rebar holding bits and pieces of it together, I thought it kind of made sense that it would fall away if you just sort of imagine a dome structure collapsing from the center, and if it had that kind of connectivity as it was falling, it would, you know, just physically, you'd think as it would start to collapse, if it collapsed from the apex, then it would sort of fold in, and the pieces would probably not fall directly down in the direct center, right? They would sort of swing back and start to fall back around the outside edges. And I thought that was pretty cool. It totally worked for me.
Hey, can I do two shout-outs? Because we haven't mentioned them in passing, and I just think there were two things I'd really like to... One of them is just a performance. I thought that the Elizabeth Banks Effie thing was just spectacularly good. And it wasn't until I saw some, you know, red carpet shots that I actually realized who she was under all that makeup.
Yeah.
And
she's great.
Yeah. And apparently she does quite a lot of producing work as well. She's like, she's just not an actress. She's a director and a producer.
Yeah, she did that movie, the singing movie.
Pitch Perfect?
Pitch Perfect, yeah. Yeah. Her and her husband produced that film.
Yeah, so... I mean, obviously, she's done a ton of other stuff from Spider-Man to whatever. But, yeah, and I thought she was great. But the other one I wanted to shout out was whoever did the craft design on the flying spaceship, the one that they took off in to go to the arena, and a modified version of which was seen later. It had a really lovely sort of propulsion system with this kind of circular thing that gave some really nice heat haze. It had lots of sort of sensible... techie looking stuff. It didn't look so derivative that we've sort of felt like I'd seen it all before. It had a real style to it. I just thought for an object that's been done and done and done and done, and trying to come up with something like kind of looked original, I thought it was just a really nice, very cool design that didn't sort of throw out any sense of function for form, but still had a sort of stylistic look about it. Did either of you guys like the?
Yeah, I did too. I actually thought, in particular, I thought it was cool when you saw it from either above or below. I think we saw it more often from below. But then when we also saw it in profile, I think there's one or two shots where we saw it from the side where you could see sort of the cockpit. And then there was sort of this curved, almost sort of stealth fighter kind of, or like a Blackbird or something, you know, kind of, but it was more white, I guess, or gray. And it had this kind of curvature to it. And they even had done in the modeling, they'd even done, you know, you could see panels and seams and around the edges of where the seams were there. And that profile shot in particular, there was some like, you know, areas where it looked like, you know, dirt or dust had sort of collected in those areas and stuff. And it added a lot of realism to it too, that I thought was really good. It gave it scale as well.
Yeah. So in finishing up, I think the film was hugely successful from a visual effects point of view. It's been massively successful at the box office. As I said, I really like the fact they respected the script, because if you've got something that's working, obviously we were talking about serving the story. A lot of the discussion we have is about whether or not the story was, the visual effects were serving the story and stuff. But yeah, at the fundamental level, it's very disappointing if the plot is just super weak and not sort of well thought through, and you feel like it was jumping all over the place. And so the more we could get, you know, good solid scripts starting out the whole process, the happier I guess I'd be. But, you know, the acting, again, as we discussed at the outset, was a big factor in this. So all round, just a huge win. I'm certainly looking forward to the next ones, which are going to get progressively darker and blacker for those of you that haven't read the books. Trust me, this is getting pretty friggin' bleak by the end. But, hey, I don't want to give too much away. But the books...
Sorry, go ahead.
Go. Yeah.
I was going to say... The one thing that I enjoyed is a personal thing is, you know, they shot a lot of this in Atlanta, and I was in Atlanta twice in the last 6 months, and I was in the hotel that they I stayed the first time in July in the hotel, the second time in just a couple, you know, maybe a month ago, I was there for some other functions. But when they go to the new place they're staying after the new training facility, and they do that pan up of the elevator, and you see that really alien Ridley Scott looking structure. That's real.
Atlanta. I must confess, I was juvenile enough with a couple of other guys having presumably had tequila shots or something to send paper airplanes down from high up inside that same building myself. Justify it being real.
Yes. That was you.
That was me. Somebody got killed by a paper airplane through the head. Oh no!
But it was
you're learning a lot about my
see,
youth now, aren't you? Yeah.
But you know, knowing how that hotel is laid out, it was interesting to see where they placed certain sets and things to like take advantage of the architecture and be like, oh well, if we just put a bunch of, you know, if we make this a seating area, then it looks like it's, you know, the room they're in, but it's like a landing by the elevator. You know, it's like, you know, it's just interesting when your real world experiences can clash with some locations in a film, and you can really appreciate the production design and how they sort of, you know, work around certain constraints and make things work with, you know, architecture that wasn't meant for that specifically.
Yeah, I guess we should also, at the same token, give a yell to the costume design, because clearly this was some pretty outlandish costume designs, but by the same token, they had a validity to them that I think was quite solid. And the non-outrageous stuff of the Capitol, I also thought was really nice. Even the outfits they were wearing in District 12, I thought were all really, really good. Mm-hmm.
Well, I thought the suits they wore, too, in the games this time were pretty cool. Like, that they were kind of these, like, you know, cool-looking sort of athletic body suits. It looks like something that, you know, you'd see runners wear or skiers or something in the Olympics. I thought it was cool.
A little bit of a Logan's Run, the original overtone crossed with Truman Show, I think. But anyway,
totally.
Running Man, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So anything else you want to finish up with, Matt?
I guess the only other thing I would say is you were mentioning some of the other actors. I also thought, too, I really liked Jenna Malone I guess it's Joanna or Johanna or something. And I thought she was really great. And the line that she delivers at one point that kind of help frame a lot of what was happening psychologically with the characters, where she says that, you know, she didn't care anymore, right? Because they had nothing, there was nothing else they could take from her. And I thought all that was cool, and how she was kind of just as a sort of both a foil and then also kind of as a friend, you know, to Katniss, like someone who was sort of a peer, somebody her age in the game.
I thought it was a really great character moment for her when she got in the elevator and took her clothes off. Because it just like, she was just like, yep, that's what I'm going to do. And everyone's just like, and they cut to like a medium shot of Jenna, and then you see Jennifer Lawrence's face in the background. She's making like the weirdest, like, fuck you face, but it was really good.
Okay. So I just want to give a spoiler alert here to the next film. Okay. It's a minor spoiler. It won't ruin the plot, but, can I just make one comment that I know this?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is may not be in the films, but it's certainly in the books. But there is a really amazing backstory that comes out over the tributes that helps explain some of this. So, you know, they're quite brazen sexuality by some of them, which you might think is just them trying to be hip and cool with the film. But there's this whole backstory that when the younger tributes win, they actually get traded for sexual favors amongst the capital. And have to endure virtually prostitution because the rich just want to sleep with these kids that have won. It's really ugly, and it really explains the behavior of Finnick and her, and why she strips and stuff, and like why she's like that, because she's been abused. So it isn't just a kind of a, you know.
That's interesting. I mean, that is really dark.
Oh, it gets really dark. Yeah, and it sort of explains a bit about why they are the way they are. This kind of cheeky exterior to hide some really serious pain from how they're, even when they've won, as children, right? Because, I mean, let's not pull any punches here. So anyway, I just thought I'd mention that, but
even though this may seem name-droppy, I know Jenna. We've worked on some stuff together, and I was super pumped for her when she got this, and I think she deserves a lot of the, she's got another big role coming up. And I think I'm really excited for her sort of maybe more adult rebirth because she's really good.
Yeah.
And she's cool. Sort of, you know,
she's super cool. And she was still making movies, but it seemed like the roles had sort of gone south a little bit for her. And then she like, I feel like she's really taking control, and I think maybe Sucker Punch was the movie wasn't great, but she really like took that as a good leap, I think.
Yeah, well, no, that's I'm really glad you brought that up, because I thought it was a really solid performance, and I hope this stuff will build in the next two films, because they've got two films for the third book that I imagine they'll explore many of these kind of more subtle aspects.
And aren't
of
they?
The backstory.
They're already shooting the first part of the
Yannick Soos isn't the visual effects supervisor on 3 and 4 simply because they were heading off to shoot, and he wouldn't have had time to do the pre-production on the third film while still finishing the second. Whereas, of course, the principal cast had a lot of gap between the second and the third.
Yeah, I think they're shooting through the end of the year, since through June.
Mm. Yeah, no, it should be really good. And all right, well, thanks so much for being with us on the show, guys. Obviously, we're keen to sort of give you guys a chance to flag what you've been doing. And I know you guys do a lot of things, but Jason, what have you been up to, and where can people find you?
You can find me on the Twitters at Jason Diamond, or the website with my brother, thediamondbros.com. We're about to put up the final piece of a 13-spot campaign we did for Fila, the sneaker company. And we also just came back from L.A. not too long ago and did 7 interstitials for VH1 for their You Oughta Know concert that they did with all their sort of up-and-coming artists like Lord and Johnny Swim and Lumineers and the Haim. And then while also double dutying while we were in LA, we directed the official unboxing launch spot for the PS4 for Sony, where we got to mimic the Daft Punk unboxing that they did about a year ago, and that was from a technical standpoint, sort of what you guys might appreciate is they didn't want us to tell Daft Punk, and I know a bunch of people that work for them, and so I could have easily got the answers to a lot of questions, but Sony didn't want us to, want Daft Punk to know anything about it until after it came out. So we managed to get a hold of their exact pick list for their props, and we literally had to reverse engineer their entire spot from lens choice to positioning of the set and all sorts of stuff, lighting and everything. So it was super fun. It reminded me of the stuff I did with you, Mike, at 3210 for the FX Guide thing, where you had Scott Squires and Marty Rosenberg reverse engineer the plate.
That was great, wasn't it?
And then I think I emailed you about this, Mike. Marty Rosenberg actually shot the end tag for this spot for us back in New York. He had been flown out here from New York. So it was a cool sort of circular thing to come back around and
he's a great guy.
Work with him. Yeah, super cool.
For those of you that don't know, we're talking about somebody who's an integral part of the ILM / Kerner Optical / 3210 team, who's really a terrific effects DOP and just a really nice guy.
Yeah. So that's what we've been doing.
And Matt?
Oh, yeah, you can always find me on Twitter. I'm Matt Wallen on there. And then I'm at Virginia Commonwealth University, although the semester is rapidly drawing to a close. And just one thing I'd send out to any listeners out there, anybody who works with or is an expert in the field of motion capture, it looks like we're going to have a little chunk of change at the school, and we're going to invest in, we're putting together a new building, and we're going to invest in some motion capture gear. And I'd love to get, I don't know, any listeners input as well. I've got a couple feelers out with a couple old colleagues, but it'd be fun if anybody wanted to send me a note of, you know, maybe systems that they've used and that they think would be something that would be fun to use in a academic environment.
Cool. Well, of course, please send that through. I'm obviously Mike Seymour on Twitter, and obviously you'll see me at FX Guide. And we've got a lot of really cool stories coming out at the moment. We've got a huge one on digital faces we've just done, which I was talking about, I think, a week or so ago. So check all that out. And I want to thank our producers and our editors and team, Todd and the guys, for putting all the stuff together. And thank you so much for being with us this week. In the words of Wires, TikTok, we've got to go. So thank you so much, guys, and we'll catch you on the flip side. See you guys.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2012, FX Guide, LLC.